This is a recording. This is a recording made on the morning of July the 8th, 1970, at the home of Dean Norman Volk at 1137 Glenway in West Lafayette. The interview is with Mr. Eccles of the Department of History, and it is for the Purdue University Archives. Dean Volk, supposing we start out in the prosaic manner, would you discuss your background in the sense of where you went to public school and your college and research background up to the time that you came to Purdue?
Well, I was born in Ocotta Falls, Wisconsin on January 16th, 1901. And my public education, I was educated at the public schools in Ocotta Falls, Wisconsin through high school. From there, I went to the University of Wisconsin in 1919, got my BS degree.
Did you graduate from high school?
I graduated from high school.
All right.
BS degree from Wisconsin in 1923 in soil chemistry, and then went on for a master's degree in 1924 in the same field. I then went to Texas for 2 years as assistant chemist at the, Texas A&M, where I did mainly routine analytical work in a control laboratory, and I also did research on the cotton wilt organism, which is a soil-borne disease. As a result of this little research work that I was doing, I was invited by United Fruit Company to join their staff in 1926, and I went to the tropics at that time with headquarters in Taylor, Honduras, where I worked on the banana wilt disease of the banana plant in its relation to soils. I spent until 1930 in the tropics with the United Fruit Company, and then came back to Wisconsin and finished up my PhD degree in 1932 and remained there as an assistant for one extra year, then going back to the tropics as head of research for the United Fruit Company.
Let me ask you, do you think the United Fruit Company was an imperialist company?
They were in the early days an imperialist company, but they have changed tremendously over the years until they are a company that has done many wonderful things for the Central American people. But in the early days, they were considered an imperialist.
In other words,
country.
The government did what the United Fruit wanted them to do.
This is more or less, they had ways of getting the things done that they wanted to get done because the governments were small and weak.
Has the change been brought about by the growth of power and of sophistication and maturity within the economies and the political life of the countries, do you think?
I think this is right. There were pressures from various angles, and the company saw that it was to their benefit to change their policies and become more interrelated in the economy of the country and more interested in the countries themselves than in just their own profit motives. That's right.
So, all right, we got you back to Wisconsin. Getting your PhD.
Yes. Well, I finished the PhD, as I say, in 1932.
What was the subject of your thesis?
My thesis was again the fixation of potash in the soil, and this was a joint effort between the geology department and the soils department of Wisconsin. And my major was a joint major between soil chemistry and geology. And of course, this fit in my program very well for my future work.
Well now, were you invited to come to Purdue at this time?
No, I went back to the tropics as head of the research department for the United Fruit Company, and I remained there until 1936. And in 1936, I was offered a job as soil chemist at Auburn University in Alabama. And I came there in 1936 and remained there until 1944, when I was contacted regarding the head of the Department of Agronomy at Purdue. I had been head of the Department of Agronomy at Auburn, Alabama, before coming to
Who contacted you at Purdue?
Dean Reed, Dean Harry J. Reed.
Harry.
That's right. And I came up and looked over the situation and decided that head of agronomy at Purdue offered more opportunities than head of agronomy at Auburn University in Alabama.
Lack of money at Alabama, or more interested at Purdue, more in the thing that you wanted to do?
Well, my main reason for coming to Purdue was that I was very much interested in developing a graduate program in research in agronomy. And this I couldn't do at Auburn, Alabama, because they only gave the master's degree level degree down there. And I felt like if I came to Purdue, after talking with Dean Reed and President Elliott, that they would support a program of research. I was also interested in education and agronomy. I felt like there was far too much of the trade school type of activity in most of the agronomic teaching, and I'd like to see it put on a little higher level. This is another reason for coming to Purdue. So I accepted the offer that they gave me and came to Purdue. And 6 months after I arrived at Purdue, I was made associate director of the Agricultural Experiment Station. And I carried both jobs, the head of the Department of Agronomy and the directorship of the experiment station, until 1949, when Dr. Peterson was brought in and made head of agronomy. And I devoted all my efforts then to the work of the entire experiment station.
You're talking about the experiment station. Would you tell us something about when and why the Agriculture Experiment Station was established? What was the problem at the time and why it was done?
The Agriculture Experiment Station was established by an act of Congress in 1887, known as the Hatch Act. And it was created because farming units were small. You know, 40 acres to 500 acres, or even 1,000 acres or 5,000 acres. These units were too small to do any research themselves. And if agriculture was to progress and meet the needs of the nation, there had to be a research program to support agriculture.
May I say, for the benefit of the tape, that the roaring noise is rain that we hear outside, and so that the secretary is not to be disturbed by this. Excuse me, go on. Go ahead.
Well, the experiment stations were established in 1887 with a total budget of $15,000 appropriated by the U.S. Congress. State legislature also passed a law creating the experiment station. So the experiment station is a unit set up by law, both federal and state, to conduct research work. I believe it's the only facility at Purdue University that is set up by law for this purpose. So that has to be our first objective, is to do research. Now, the objectives set up in the law, the federal law, were to help solve the problems of agriculture and to disseminate that information to farmers. More recently, the Extension Service has been created in the early 1920s. Well, I guess it was a little before that, maybe, to disseminate the information. So the experiment station does not disseminate the information out into the through the Extension Service anymore. We also had to provide information for the teaching staff. This was another job that the experiment station was set up to do. Now, the major objectives of the experiment are to conduct applied research for the benefit of agriculture and the associated industries. That is the main objective. But in addition to that, and this is not written in the law, but in addition to that, we must do a certain amount of so-called basic research to undergird the applied research. If you don't, you soon run out of tools with which to work, because you've got to add new information in order to answer the problems of the practical agriculture and the associated industries. So I feel that the experiment station should carry on a sizable amount of so-called basic research for simply for the accumulation of new knowledge for man.
When you did this, did you have these directed to Indiana problems or problems of the region or national problems on a national level?
Well, all three. Our main objective was to help the Indiana farmer. We also are in a regional organization. The North Central states have 12 states that are combined together in an organization that we do regional research that crosses state boundaries.
Does this have anything to do with the idea of the land-grant college?
Oh yes, yes, the experiment station is a part of the land-grant college. That's right, part of the land-grant college. Now then, we also have national projects, projects that go nationwide, that states in other regions, maybe California and New York, will be cooperating on a project that Purdue is interested in. So it isn't just for Indiana, but that is our first objective. I mean, as far as service is concerned. Now, a third objective is that of training scientists. We have, the experiment station has, very fine facilities for doing research. We have a very fine staff, so it makes an ideal place for graduate students to carry on their research activities. So all of the graduate students in agriculture do their research in the agricultural experiment station. And they get most of their funding, most of their support from the agricultural experiment station. So the 600 or more graduate students that we have in agriculture today are really part of the experiment station staff. Though, of course, their formal classroom training and so on is done in the School of Agriculture and other schools of the university.
Well, now you've been here long enough to see some changes. Let's approach it in terms of problems. What were the main problems of 25 years ago and that you had, and, some of the changes that have come since then?
Well, when I arrived at Purdue, it was very obvious that if I was going to have any success in working with the staff to carry out the objectives that I had when I came here, it would be necessary that we make some additions to the staff, considerable additions to the staff. The staff that existed at Purdue in agriculture when I came here were well qualified to carry on the practical type of research that I have referred to.
To discover whether the soil was acid or alkaline.
This is right. Fertilizer applications and this type of thing, breeding new crops and this type of thing. But when it come to the basic type research that I'm talking about and supporting a graduate student program, our staff, we only had a minimum number of people qualified for that type of work. So the first thing that I had to do was to work with the dean and with the president, and they were both very helpful and very encouraging, and we hired a number of outstanding people who had already proved themselves. In other words, we went out to other institutions and robbed a few people from other institutions in order to...
More polite word is either raid or entice.
That's right.
But anyway, we
got them. And
I'm curious, where'd you find them?
Well, of course, I went back to my alma mater at Wisconsin for some of them, and we went to other institutions that knew about, that were very that has a very outstanding
man. I'm just curious, would a place like Cornell or a place like Oklahoma State have men interested in agronomy?
Oh, yes. Cornell is one of the leading states, yes. And Oklahoma is very good, too. Yes, I know a number of people in Oklahoma, and they were one of the leaders in the early days in the agronomic field. We didn't have too much difficulty getting these few key people that we needed. And after we got these, then it was rather easy after that to build our staff. And after a while, then we began to hire less experienced people, but men with tremendous potentialities, like Joe White, who was just a fresh PhD when we got him, and now he's internationally known as a scientist in his field of clay mineralogy. Probably no man better qualified in his field than Joe White. Well, I'm just using him as an example of a fresh PhD that had lots of potential. And these are the types of men we hired later on. Until we have built a staff at Purdue that I am sure would rank with the best in the nation, probably the top three in the nation. And it was not that kind of a staff 25 years ago.
Were any of your problems in getting buildings and building facilities? You got to have a place for a guy to work. Did you have to build a lot on that?
Yes. The business of getting buildings was something of an very important problem. Back in 1945, the facilities at Purdue were relatively poor, I would say. They were quite inadequate for a research program in an experiment station. And a tremendous effort was put forward to get additional facilities. Now, some of the facilities that we have added in the past 25 years was an addition to the biochemistry building, which more than doubled the space there. The life science building, which houses agronomy, botany, and plant pathology, and animal sciences, plus biology now. The greenhouses, for example, in agronomy, they only had 1/4 of a greenhouse range. And today, they have 4 or 5 complete greenhouse ranges. It was terrific. The shortage of greenhouse space. Then we built the Herrick Environmental Laboratories, in which we have 2 of the finest large animal chambers in the world today for doing research on an animal environment. We built a new poultry building. We built the new vet science laboratories, which are extremely important in the study of animal diseases, animal health. Then the Cranet Building. There's another new building which Agricultural Economics is now housed, plus other departments. Entomology built their new environmental facility, which is considered to be the finest of its type. In fact, it is a few years ago, unless somebody else has built one, it was the only one of its type in the nation. It was an experimental unit in which you can create conditions from Alaska to the tropics in some of these chambers that they have. Then we had the new agronomic farm facility. When I came here, the old farm was on the other side of Lafayette, a rather small farm, something like 200 acres. Now we have in the neighborhood of 500 acres north of Lafayette of a very fine and efficient agronomic farm. And we also have recently purchased something over a section of land for the animal science department for their new farms. So these are some of the facilities that have been added to Purdue University. I would say that I can't give an exact figure on this because I don't know about the floor space, but I would say that the floor space in the experiment station now for conducting research is at 3 or 4 times what it was in 1945.
Can we go into the problem of planning and in research programs, and can you tell us something about that, or are we going too fast?
No, that's a very important phase of agriculture experiment station work, is the planning of a program. Because, of course, you have limited funds and limited facilities and limited personnel. You never have all of these that you need. So it takes careful planning to be sure that you're using these three resources efficiently. And as I said before, by law we're created to do research. So that is our main objective. Now, in planning research, one, of course, must consider the researchers themselves. I'm a firm believer that a man ought to be working on things that he's interested in working on if he's going to be really successful. He should be handed a few jobs, urgent jobs that need to be done, but his main effort ought to be one that he is primarily interested in himself. And the administrator's overall responsibility is a coordinator, really, of the whole program. The facilities must be available before you start into a program, and they must be suitable. You must have the proper equipment and so on. And the financial support must be there before you can go into a program of research. And one of the most important things is determining the priority of problems. There are so many, 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 many problems to work on.
Well, as you
which are you going to work on first, and how much support are you going to give to them?
How did you determine your priorities? Based upon Indiana needs, or upon needs of research that, let's say you hear about something in Germany that is being done?
Well,
and then you try
they
to
come from many sources. The extension people in Indiana will send in suggestions for needs. Farmers will send in suggestions for needs. Industry will send in suggestions. Our staff has just lots of ideas of problems that need solving that farmers and extension people wouldn't recognize because they're not trained to recognize the problem that needs solving. And so that in sorting out what should be done, first let me say we have a project system at Purdue that I created when I came here, that every piece of work must be covered by a project. Now we have what we call major projects, which are ones of considerable magnitude, representing thousands of dollars of expenditures, and rather important problems. Most of our basic research falls in this area, and some of our more advanced applied research. Then we have what we call minor projects, which cover things like fertilizer trials, crop trials, and milk testing, and a lot of things of this sort that are more of applied type of a problem that are rather routine. Then we have what we call the exploratory project. And this is, a man may get an idea, any research worker, that here's something I think that ought to be looked into. Well, we'll let him spend 1 year working on this project, not his full time, but provide him with $600 or $1,000 to go ahead and do whatever he can do in a year's time to prove whether or not this is a fruitful area to work in. So we have these three types of projects. Now, none of these projects can be initiated until they pass through a departmental project committee, so that it has to clear the department first. The department has to say, yes, this is a high priority project. We want to go ahead with it. Then it comes to the station research committee, which consists of one member from each of about 10 of the departments. They're all well-known scientists at Beyondview. And they review this. Is this a high priority project from the standpoint of the station as a whole? Or should something in veterinary take priority over this, or something in agricultural economics take priority over this for the money available? If it passes through there, then with approval, that is, the committees make a recommendation to the director. And the director makes the final decision as to whether the project will go ahead or not, because one man has to finally make this decision. Now then, all projects that are supported with federal funds must also go to Washington to be screened there in case this same work is being done at some other institution. We don't want duplication any place in the country unless duplication is necessary for verification. So these projects get a thorough screening. So by this technique, we can come up with a rather nicely coordinated program of research. Now when we have larger areas of research like, marketing, for example, which you'll find in animal science, you'll find it in agronomy, you'll find it in agricultural economics, you find it scattered all over the experiment station. Then we set up what we call an institute. And this institute is for the purpose of coordinating a broad field of research that may be composed of anywhere from 3 or 4 projects up to maybe 15 or 20 projects. And the job of the institute is to coordinate the research work in that area. They also coordinate the teaching in that area and the extension work in that area. And these we call institutes. And we have a number of those in the experiment stations that cover these broad areas. So this is another phase of our effort to program our research.
Now, you run into problems, don't you, or do you run into problems, when you have your research supported by grants, special grants?
Yes, we do. You see, it's pretty difficult for an industrial concern to put up money to work on a problem and not have selfish interest. This is just natural. I worked with a commercial company long enough to know that they have selfish interests, and they have to have, for survival purposes, they have to have. So when they contribute money for a program of research, they must understand that we are going to publish the results, whether they are favorable to the company, to their problems, or whether they are not favorable to them.
In other words, you have to do that
ahead of time.
You tell the company, you cannot ask us to do this work for you in place of your science, your own boys, and then have it kept secret.
That's right.
In other words, if we're going to do applied research in this instance, the world must know about it.
That's right. We will not use our facilities, personnel, our resources, to do research that cannot be published. So it must be published. That has to be understood of the company. The proposal has to fit in with our overall program of the station. In other words, it's got to be fit into some phase of our research. And somebody at our station has to be interested in it. We just won't saddle a piece of research on an individual. Now, this doesn't very often happen that you would have to even consider doing this, because usually it's the individual that goes out and gets the grant on something he's interested in. There's another problem. Donors once in a while want to dictate. Well, you have to resist this. Sure, we want them to have conference with us and so on, but we do not want to be dictated to with respect to our research. We also have to have protection against the sudden withdrawal of funds.
Yes, I should think that would be very important.
There are some, I have had one company that withdrew their funds when a piece of research was half through. This was very expensive to the station, and needless to say, we didn't accept any more funds from that particular company.
You get government grants for specific...
Yes.
But the government grants are given on the understanding that there's no difficulty about not publishing. So.
We have a program drawn up before the grant that's agreeable to us and to the government before the grant is ever made.
It would be my guess that with the Department of Agriculture in Washington, you could coordinate these grants so that the various experimental stations elsewhere in here would dovetail into.
This is right, yes. We have a national coordinating organization all the way from the Department of Agriculture. There's a section in the Department of Agriculture called the States Experiment Station Service, which is the national coordinating agency for all of the experiment stations. And they have in their files a copy of every single project in all of the experiment stations. So that if there's a project being initiated in Texas, for example, this organization will know whether Purdue University has got something going on in that field, and they'll tell them they better contact us and find out what we're doing and before they get final approval on their projects.
All right. Now, there's always a problem when you have applied research here as an industry. I've been in industry a little, and the McClure Park concept is one way to answer the problems of having a university dedicated to problems of public nature to work with applied science. Now, when should a station, in a sense, compete with research carried on by a private company? Can you give me some examples of this? And sort of help solve the problem or discuss the problem?
I got something like that.
All right. You want me to stop the tape?
Yes, would you make just for a minute?
All right, we'll stop for a second. We're back on the tape now. All right, let us discuss about this matter of competition with agricultural private interests.
Occasionally a staff member wants to carry on research on problems that the administration believes are being adequately researched by private organizations. Consequently, I have taken the position over the years of following these guidelines. We should compete with private industry when private groups are not doing an adequate job of research to serve agriculture. We should compete when the institution has an obligation in a specific area to serve agriculture.
Can you give us an example?
Well, in the early days of the experiment station, when I first came here, we felt that we had to develop new crop varieties for the farmers of Indiana. Private interests were also developing crop varieties, but we weren't sure that the private industry was going to do an adequate job of this at the time. So we had a pretty large staff, quite a large staff, that devoted its entire time to devoting new corn varieties, new wheat varieties, soybean varieties, and so on. And industry, over the years, began to resent this. And we finally, after industry proved that they could do this job adequately and were actually producing better varieties on the whole than we could because they had greater resources than the university had to do these jobs. We then took the position, changed our policy, and said, we will now minimize the development of new varieties. And we felt that we were obligated, however, to carry on a certain amount of this type of research in order to train scientists
to serve industry.
To serve industry.
Yes.
See?
Well, that's sensible.
So that's the
that's
obligation.
Sensible.
See?
That's
yes.
Sensible.
When we need to be active in an area of research for the purpose of training graduate students, then we say we should still compete with industries. And because otherwise, how are we going to train people that industry can use? We should not compete with industry when the private group, in our opinion, is doing an adequate job. Now, this isn't always agreeable to our staff because there are times when our staff would... This is their pet, so to speak, and they want to continue with it. And we've had some quite heart-to-heart discussions on whether a staff member should change his objective now and not continue down the road that he's been doing because, been going because industry is adequately covering this area. So why spend public funds to do what private funds will do?
That can be hard on a man, though, can it?
Yes, it can be. And some of the older men who have done this all their life are allowed to continue to do it, even though, in our opinion, his productivity is rather low in competition with the productivity of the scientists in the industry.
I noticed one thing that you have that you would you want to put on record are, and I are there these research institutes, and I must confess I had not heard about them.
Yeah.
Will you tell me something about them? First, did you originate them or help originate them?
Yes, this was done in consultation and conference with our department heads, who were intensely involved in the researches in their own areas, and yet they could see that there are problems that cross departmental lines and that of a rather major category, and needed some coordination of some kind or another. So we first tried this in the field of marketing, and it worked very well. This is the oldest research institute. I think it's about 25 years old and still going.
Was Earl Butz part of this?
Earl Butz was a part of this when he was a department head, that's right. And this institute has had a very busy time all these years coordinating the marketing research in the various departments. Now, in an institute, we still leave the staff in the department. They're administered by the department, and the funds are handled by the department. But the program is coordinated and built by the institute. Acceptable, of course, to the individual departments. No project is put in a department unless that department is willing to accept it. And the funding that goes with it goes into the department.
Can you give me an example, a specific example of one or two?
Well, the Marketing Institute is the first one I gave you. Another institute is the Utilization Research Institute. This was created in about 20 years ago. This is the utilization of agricultural projects for non-feed and food uses. In other words, for paper making and all types of things like this. Utilization of starch in the iron industry. And there's a lot of things that you can do with agricultural products besides eat them by animals or man. So this was set up for studying the utilization of agricultural products. Then we have the Food Science Institute. Now, food science goes all across the board. Home economics, agricultural engineering and the mechanized part of it. In the animal science department, standpoint of the quality of beef and so on, in the agronomic departments and the pathology, horticulture, all of these departments are involved in food science. So we set up a food science only about 5 or 6 years ago to handle this area. Then we have a population genetics science institute, I mean. And this institute has to do with the study of population genetics. And all of the animal science areas are involved in this, as well as some of the plant science fields are involved in this. So these are the examples of the institutes that we have at the present time, and are some of the smaller ones. Institutes are to stimulate and coordinate also the teaching and extension programs, as I mentioned earlier. So they not only coordinate the research and develop a program, they also develop a program of teaching and a program of extension work, and they coordinate it in conjunction with the department. So that is the Research Institute idea, and it seems to answer the problem that we've had of
these
broad
areas. Was this
peculiar
to Purdue, or was it general practice in other agricultural
organizations? Well, I tell you, it was, I think Purdue, this was probably, Purdue was a leader in this, because I have been asked to talk on this subject in a great many experiment stations over the United States and also in the Department of Agriculture. How do you go about setting up an organization to coordinate agricultural research in these broad areas? And I think many other institutions now have, maybe they don't call them institutes, they may call them something else, but they have similar types of organizations in many of the experiment stations over the country and many of the colleges and so on that are not connected with experiment stations.
So this is, in a way, sort of, if not originated at Purdue, Purdue's sort of a first in getting this
That's
going.
Right. I think Purdue was probably the leader in this area, and I don't know whether they were first.
Did you get this as a result of your experience at Auburn and elsewhere, or did you just see a need?
It was just a need. We come up against these problems. I think the first one that was, the first one that I bumped into when I came here was the Farm Bureau was offered us a considerable sum of money to make a study of the alfalfa crop. Everything involved in the alfalfa, from the growing of it, the nutrition of it, to the feeding of it, and the nutrition of the animals and all of this. And to start this off, I set up a program and of a coordinating program. I didn't call it an institute then. I just called it a coordinating program. And we got all these projects together and we got everybody agreed with them, and then we disseminated them back to the departments. But we had a committee that met about four times a year that reviewed all the work and took a new look at where they ought to go from there. This was, I think, probably the start of this type of a research program. Now, the Marketing Institute had been created, I believe, a little bit. No, the Marketing Institute was created after that. It was created when the Research and Marketing Act came in. So I think that was the first one. Then we had another one that came up later on when the Lilly Foundation provided about $500,000 to do research on minor elements. Well, this thing cut all across the board, from plants to animals to humans to nutrition. And again, we set up a program for this. And we didn't call this an institute at that time. It wasn't until the Marketing Institute came along that we called it an institute. And from then on, we called them institutes.
Have you worked with other agricultural stations on general problems of this in these institutes?
Oh, yes. As I say, I've been called as a consultant.
Yeah, but I mean, do you have projects going in common? That is, Wisconsin will take half of it and Purdue will take half?
Well, yes. We don't call these institutes now. We call these regional projects.
Yeah.
For example, we have a project on apple breeding that involves Purdue University, the University of Illinois, the University of New Jersey, a school in England, and a school in Canada. I don't think that's all of them. I think there's one or two more. Here is not only a regional but an international project for the breeding of apples for scab resistance. This was started about 20 years ago between Purdue and Illinois, when folks didn't think that apple breeding was worthwhile at all. They were spraying anywhere from 15 to 18 times a year to control apple scab, very expensive. And we had two young men, one at Purdue, Ralph Shea, who is now head of the Department of Pathology out of Oregon State, and a fellow by the name of Huff over at Illinois, that were young enough so that they didn't know this couldn't be done, and they went ahead and worked on this thing. We put up $5,000 apiece, Purdue and Illinois. And from this has grown this international project. So it doesn't just involve Purdue alone. You could call this an institute, but really, it's just a well-coordinated program of research.
I would have imagined this would have taken place. Well, now we're on the problem of research. Talk for a little while on the problem of agricultural research and where it is going and what the future is and what can be done. I should think you'd have a tremendous problem in agricultural research, largely because you're going to have to feed more people and there are fewer people going to be working on the land and so on.
Well, you see, The frontier of agriculture used to be land. When you wore out a piece of land in New Jersey, then you moved west.
Moved to Ohio.
Then when you wore it out in Ohio, you moved to Indiana. And you just kept hopping until you got to the Pacific coast. Today, there's practically no more new land. The fact is, agricultural land is reducing in acreage because of the expanding of the cities, railroads, highways, and all this. We're actually having a reduction. So we can no longer consider that new land is the frontier of agriculture if we're going to increase production. I term what we have to do now is carry on vertical agriculture. We've got to produce more and more and more and more per acre. How do you do this? Only by applying new knowledge. Therefore, the problems of research are even more intense today in agriculture than they were in the past, because we now have to search for ways of doing almost the impossible in many cases, continue to increase the production on land. Let me give you one example. We've been producing wheats for years, and the production kind of leveled off at, say, 45 bushels per acre. Our wheats were some of the best in the nation from the standpoint of their quality and all that. Yet we had reached what looked like a level until our researchers got hold of what we call some short straw dwarf wheats that looked like they might have some potential for shortening the straw so that if they put a lot of wheat on the head of the straw, it wouldn't fall over. This was a problem. You get too much wheat on the top and it falls down, you can't harvest it.
I've been a farmer in Nebraska. I know what you're talking about.
So they developed these short straw varieties, and now we got wheats that will produce up in the 70s, 80s bushels per acre.
Does it depend on the kind of soil?
Well, you have to fertilize well, sure.
Yes.
Yes, and you have to grow wheat on certain kinds of soil. It won't grow on well on, it doesn't grow as well on some of the Indiana prairie soils as it does on our lighter colored soils. So you have to get these maximum yields, you have to have the right soil, and you got to fertilize well. That's right. You got to farm well in order to do this. But here is a case where this is vertical agriculture. We have to do the same thing in animals. Now we produce a pound of poultry meat for, I guess, less than 2 pounds of feed. Well, in some of the other animals, it takes 3 and 4 and 5 pounds of feed to produce a pound of meat. If you're going to get vertical agriculture moving in these larger animals, we're going to have to get the efficiency of these animals up to where they can produce more per pound of feed. And so this is the type of research that we have to carry out, but underneath it, in order to do this, we've got to have this basic research that gets us the new tools to work with. We can't do it with the tools we have. We have to get new tools all the time. So as I see it, agricultural research is essential. It must expand, really, in order to meet the needs of the people of the world, unless there's some control in the population of the world, agriculture is going to be hard-pressed to meet the needs. Now, on the world as a whole, there's a lot of land that can be developed. I was an explorer for half the time that I was with the United Fruit Company, and I explored millions of acres of undeveloped land.
Can it be used in tropical areas?
Oh, yes. And we have large resources of undeveloped land in the nation. But again, to use this land is going to take research. And these countries that have this land do not have the research facilities or the research brains yet in quantity to solve their problems. So,
you see, I lost a fortune, or my family lost a fortune, in the drought in Nebraska. But I remember in 1934 and 5, if you got 20 bushels an acre on this beautiful soil in eastern Nebraska, you were doing well.
Yeah, sure.
Now, they solved that by building artesian wells in our county. And so you got, when there was no rain, you got, you lowered the water table, but you did get water. And we haven't had a crop failure since.
That's right.
And now, this is the sort of thing you're talking
about.
That's
right. And along with that, they applied fertilizer before.
Yes.
They couldn't apply fertilizer before because they didn't have enough water for the plant to make use of it.
That's right. And they had you had to prepare the soil for it, which meant an education of the farmer.
Yeah. I just want to...
This is a fascinating topic.
Give you a little example here. For example, in 1917 in Indiana, practically all the land in Indiana that was suitable for agriculture was in agriculture, but it wasn't all producing like it ought to produce. And the corn crop at that time was about 200 million bushels of corn, on about the same acreage that we have now in corn. And today, it's nearly a half a billion bushels. 2.5 times as much. Well, actually 2.5 times as much on less acreage. The acreage in 1917 was 6 million, and it's only 5 million now, so 2.5 times as much. Well, the corn yields jumped from 35 bushels to 84 bushels in that length of time. This is vertical agriculture. Wheat jumped from 17 bushels to a state average of 44 bushels. Soybeans jumped from 19 bushels to 26, and now that's up to 35.
Soybeans are something I never heard about in Nebraska. Yeah.
And sorghum jumped from 27 bushels up to 65, and we got varieties that produce 250 and 300 bushels now that aren't in use, that are, they're just beginning to use. So. This is what I mean when I talk about vertical agriculture. And these are very simple things that I'm giving.
Did you work on any of these things personally in your own research? Or
well, when I was in Alabama, yes. But when I came here, I devoted my entire effort to the administration of research.
You have to do quite a lot of reading to find out what's going on elsewhere, don't you?
Oh, yes. Yes, that's... every research worker, of course, has to do this, and the administrator should, and I tried to, keep up with all of the work in the experiment station. Now, I don't mean understand it.
But at least know what's going on.
Know there. What's going on.
Do you do this for the Soviet, for the Russians, too, and for the Germans and else, the English?
You mean, does the research worker do this? Oh, yes. He has to. He has to keep up. You see, each research worker represents a rather small area. And he can keep up on his small area.
He should.
Fairly effectively with the
what
tools that we have today.
What about the African nations? It seemed to me that one of the great problems of Africa is getting enough to eat. This Biafran-Nigerian situation showed such a lamentable lack of agricultural development.
Well, that's right. They just haven't got the crop improvement they need or the production practices that they need to produce anywhere near the maximum. I'll just give you one example, and it won't be in Africa because I don't know Africa, but I have been to Pakistan. I went to Pakistan on the wheat mission in 1954, and their average yield, as I recall then, was about 17 bushels per acre of wheat. And we were over there to find out whether or not the United States should provide them some wheat to keep them from starving to death. And we found that, of course, that they needed the wheat. There wasn't any question about that. But the thing that they needed more than they needed wheat in the long run were cultural practices, the proper use of their water. They needed fertilizers. Why, they didn't apply fertilizer. Here they were growing wheat on these lands for I don't know how many thousands of years and still weren't applying any fertilizer to them. They were using these old, old, ancient varieties of wheat that would produce wheat on those very poor lands. Our good wheats wouldn't even live on them, I expect, because they have much higher demand for nutrition. Well, the Rockefeller Institute developed a wheat in Mexico that is good for these climates, and this wheat has been taken to Pakistan and other eastern countries where wheat is their main food crop instead of rice, and they have doubled their yields just overnight by applying fertilizer and using new varieties of wheat. Now these countries have existed for 5,000 years.
Yeah.
And in less than 5 years, when they got the new varieties of wheat and started putting fertilizer on, they doubled their yields. Now they're exporters of wheat, and they were importers of wheat before.
What they need then is about 25 years of good science.
They need additional research work. This is right.
Instead of giving them money to build up their armies, then we ought to give them money and specify that they use it for research in ag.
Yeah. This, of course, is getting into politics.
Getting into high politics, isn't it?
Yeah, this is getting into politics. But I am a firm believer in the distribution of knowledge to these countries, and the distribution of some people to these countries that have the right objective, that can take the knowledge that they have and apply it to those conditions, not take our results and try to apply them.
Aren't we trying to do that in Brazil?
That's right.
Colombia.
Brazil, and it's very effective in Brazil.
Is it working in Brazil?
It's working very effectively.
In other words, that 75-mile band of goes the coast north south, that may expand into a really great area in the hinterland, the back country.
Oh yes, yeah. Brazil has terrific potential if they just will seriously go ahead and develop an organization.
The problem there is the Brazilian himself.
I found out when I was down there. That's right. There's a different philosophy among these people. Central America the same way. You have the same thing in Central America. I've said many times that I think that the progress in Central America would be many-fold what it is today if they had an influx of a sufficient number of people from other countries that have shown their ability to progress.
In other words, if they take, for example, Western European refugees,
and take them in there, they would make a lot of more headway. But of course, these countries are pretty well populated now, and this would be probably a burden on their population.
You have a sociological problem in there for a while.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I'm interested in one thing. What is the future of agricultural research pretty well plotted out? You talk about vertical work. I mean, it is along these lines of developing vertically.
This is right. Yes.
And
now, this is the way we have to go. And this is the way they are going. And it's about the only way they can go.
Well, I would think so.
Yeah.
You know, we were always taught when we talked about problems of war with Russia that when the Russians get to the place where they can feed themselves as well as use industry, then we'd better watch out because they'll have a balanced economy. What's been the handicap in Russia? I know that they emphasize so much the developing of Turkestan, for example,
yeah,
as crop producing, and the Siberian wheat is wonderful. You get a hearty, marvelous crop in 3 weeks and so on. Is their agriculture catching up with ours?
Their agriculture is catching up. The problem in Russia in the past has been that they've had a peon-type agriculture system. Like they have the Milpa system of agriculture in Central America. Just a small plot of land that one man devotes his whole energies to, and he can't afford to farm it right. He can't afford the fertilizers. He can't afford the right kind of seed. He can't afford machinery. So as a result, the yields are low. Well, Russia was faced with this, and of course they're mechanizing now. And they're also, the Russians are smart people. They're taking a lot of the technology in the United States, and they're developing a lot of technology themselves. And in time, they are going to be a very respectable agricultural nation, I feel.
What nation next to ours would you say uses agricultural science and technology best?
Well, Germany and Holland.
I remember meeting a man from Germany who taught agronomy at the University of Missouri when I lived in Columbia several years ago. And he said that Germany was as good, if not better, than the United States and so on.
Well, I would expect him to say that. I would say that he was a little optimistic, a little.
Well, naturally, but after all,
I'd say if there's
a German PhD.
If there's one country that probably is giving us a good race, it's the Netherlands. This country is
the Dutch are good.
Yeah, I
respect the Italians though. Yeah. They haven't got any money, but they haven't got any money, and apparently they know how to do something with that land. Yeah. But they got the worst land in the world.
Yeah.
Is there anything that could be done in southern Italy to improve that?
Well, now northern Italy is blessed with everything that a good agriculture ought to be blessed with.
Yeah.
They have some wonderful opportunities up there. The southern part of their country is a very difficult area. I'm not familiar enough with it to be able to comment intelligently on it, but I suspect that their soils are very poor,
and
eroded,
worn out,
washed
eroded.
Away,
oh.
Rugged, hilly.
Maybe it'll develop for grazing.
And there is a use for this land. But I don't think that they have really discovered the use for this land yet.
Let me ask you, let's get back to something you've done personally. I always like to have a list of a man's achievements. I notice on your wall you have many plaques and certificates of merit and awards. Could we get a list of those appended to our interview?
Yes.
That is when the final edition, you will append it. All right.
I have.
Now, let's just mention those of which you happen to be most proud.
Well, of course, the one that I'm most proud of is the honorary doctorate degree agriculture from Purdue University.
That is indeed an honor.
To me, this is the greatest honor that anybody can ever have, is to be recognized by his own institution for his services. And this, of course, was tremendous in my opinion, and I've never had anything that quite floored me like that did when I got the letter from President Hubley on that. Well,
just name some of the agricultural honoraries, international or national associations. Have you been
some of the honors? I'm a member of Phi Sigma, which is the honorary biological, Sigma Xi, of course, which is honorary scientific, Gamma Sigma Delta, which is the honorary agricultural science, Alpha Zeta, which is honorary agriculture, Phi Zeta, which is honorary veterinary. Now, you wonder why I got this, and I wonder too, but I was told it was because of the support that I gave to the veterinary program at Purdue. You see, the School of Veterinary Science is outside of the School of Agriculture, but their research program is in the experiment station. And the support and encouragement, apparently, that I gave them in research is a reason that they gave me this honorary in veterinary. I'm a fellow of the American Society of Agronomy. I have the Certificate of Distinction from the Purdue Agricultural Alumni Association for service to the state of Indiana. And I was recognized by the United States Department of Agriculture for service to agriculture in 1 year. Those are the main honors, I would say. There's a number of other smaller ones.
But they are considerable.
Yeah.
And I think it's nice to have them.
One of the nicest ones, which really only 10 people ever got in the United States, that I was voted by all my colleagues in the United States as one of the 10 leading soil scientists in the nation.
That is indeed a distinguished honor.
So that I consider to be one of the scientist.
While we're on this, would you, just for the tape and for interest, compare Purdue's agricultural operation with that of other agricultural operations and achievements of other schools? We hear of Iowa State and Cornell and Wisconsin. How do we rate? How do you rate them?
Well, of course, now I would, anything I say could be considered to be biased, of course, because I've spent more time at Purdue than
well, I hope
have at any other place.
I hope it'll be biased.
But I think that it's truthful, too. I think now Purdue University Agriculture, College of Agriculture at Purdue, School of Agriculture at Purdue, ranks with the top in the nation. I think they are, I guess, the third in the nation in enrollment, I believe, something like this. Dean Freeman could give you these figures. I wasn't dean long enough to be able to fix those figures in my mind. Being dean only 7 months, didn't
I got them.
And a callback dean at that, you know.
Yeah.
Well, from the standpoint of the experiment station, of which I'm most familiar with and which I had more to do with than anything else, I rank the experiment station at Purdue University in the top four. I don't think there's there would be, if there's any way to measure them, I think you would have to put Purdue in the top four in the nation.
All right, what are the four? Purdue,
well,
the other three?
I'd say Cornell, Wisconsin, and California.
Davis?
Yeah, well, University of California.
University of California.
That includes Davis. So
what's happened to the South? You said you were at Auburn. Don't they have enough money, or is it...
They do not have enough money. Now they're better now. They're a lot better now. Their salaries are up. They're able to hold good staff. There was a time when the only people that you could really retain in the South were native sons or, I hate to say this, but people of lesser ability.
Yes.
From outside of the state. Now, I worked for one of the greatest men in the South, Dean Funches. And when I was there, he had a very fine young staff. I didn't want to leave Auburn because I never had worked in a place where they had such a wonderful group of young men. And Dean always used to say, I can't keep them long. But what I hire are going to be good. And he always had a good young staff, but he never could keep them more than 4 or 5 years, because just as soon as they got their head above the crowd, why, somebody would pick them off someplace that had more resources, more opportunities for them. But he had a good young staff.
What about places like, I noticed you didn't say Ames. And, of course, I come from Nebraska. I thought that Nebraska had a good ag school.
Yes, Nebraska has a good ag school, but it's small.
It's small.
Small.
Always has been.
Ames is, has a, I say the College of Agriculture at Ames is outstanding. I don't think that their research organization will compare with Purdue's.
What about...
They've been short on funds is one of the reasons. One of the reasons is that Iowa has not had the support from the state that Purdue has had.
And you would think that Iowa, mainly agricultural state, would support it.
Yeah, but that's the problem.
Is that because Iowa is owned by insurance companies?
Well, it's because, I don't know, I can't tell you why, but they just never have had the support. They just never have had the support.
You know, that's amazing, though, because Iowa is one of the most beautiful agricultural countries in the world. This is southern Wisconsin.
And another reason was, of course, I think in the early days, Iowa didn't have to lift itself by its bootstraps. Their soil was so naturally fertile and rich that you, as Dean Reed used to say about Illinois, he said, I would love to be dean in Illinois with Indiana farmers over there. And the reason he said this was because Indiana farmers had to struggle and they really knew how to farm. And if they went to Illinois, they'd make a killing because Illinois had just as good a soil as Iowa has.
I think one of the most instructive trips person who talks about this country and its resources can take is to start, let's say, from Lafayette and just drive in any direction to the Mississippi River and then go west about 500 miles.
Yeah.
There's no area in the world like that, is there?
No, that's
for
right.
agriculture, that's right. for wealth. And of course, we have our own civilization
yeah.
out here.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I'm interested in Purdue's place. So many people don't hear about it. Do you think the legislature and people of Indiana are aware of this rather unique position?
Well, you know, one of the reasons that we got support and continue to get support at Purdue for the station I'm talking about now was that we actually did produce. Our staff was very productive. And they did so much for the agriculture in the state of Indiana. We were first in so many different areas in agricultural production in Indiana.
The
legislature was at that in those earlier days had a lot of agricultural people in it.
And they
supported us.
They knew.
Not so easy now when the agricultural interests in the legislature are much smaller now.
I'm interested in something else too. You may not wish to comment on it. You worked under Dean Reed and others. Do you want to make any comment about the quality of our top administration? Don't have to if you don't
you
want
to. You mean in agriculture?
Sure.
Yeah. Well.
And in the university if you wish.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, one of the fine things about Dean Reed was when I came here, he gave me a free rein and full authority and backed me up. Now, if I made a mistake, and everybody does, he would come in and counsel me afterwards, but he would never, in public, say anything derogatory about the decision or to the staff. But he was the man that would really encourage you. He himself was not a highly trained man, as you know. When I came here, there was Dean Freeman, Director Hoffman, and Dean Reed. They had come up in the days when advanced degree work wasn't essential, and they were all excellent men in their field. They were not the highly trained men that you have in administration now at Purdue. That doesn't say that they weren't just as good or better than the men we have.
Different times.
But they had a different time and they had different problems. Their objectives were different. They had to be then than they are now. But I would say that Purdue was very fortunate that it had these three men. And when I came here for my interview, I was very much impressed with them. With these three men. And over the years, I had wonderful cooperation from Roy Hoffman as an extension director and wonderful cooperation from Dean Freeman. I don't know of any three men that had fewer arguments than we had, that were in rather important positions. And I think this made a whole lot for the progress. We weren't fighting each other or each other's group.
University Hall been pretty, the executive building been pretty good to you?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I can't, they get awful rough with you at times, you know, but as a whole, I would say that the support that I got from the top administration in the university has been very good, and the advice and counsel has been very good, and yet, on the other hand, they haven't hesitated when they saw it, they had to maybe put the damper on some of the
sure. They have
proposals that we would put forward. See.
But on the whole, Hupti's administration has been one to encourage and support.
Oh, yes. And a man that you could depend on to go to bat for you if you got into difficulties at any time. And the I remember that if I really was in need of financial support, really in need now, and properly prepared myself, I could go to R.B. Stewart when he was vice president and I could get the support I needed. It seldom failed.
Can you do
but
it
you
now?
Couldn't go in there with a a halfway proposal and get by with it, because he'd see through it as quickly as anybody I know. So you, and as far as it is now, I think that they're having the same kind of success now, except money is so much tighter that there isn't the money to draw on that there was when I was ready. I figure that I came through my administrative experience at Purdue University in the golden era. The era when the federal funds were increasing rapidly through our efforts, the various experiment station directors, working with Congress, we got the appropriations increased. That I haven't given you that information out of. For example, the state appropriations increased from 1945 until I retired 500% for research.
Marvelous.
The federal appropriations increased 800%. Now, this is due to working with Congress. The contracts and grants increased 1,000%. And the sales and fees, the sales from our farms and so on, increased 220%. So we overall had an overall increase of over 500%.
Can you round that out in dollars?
It was about $1,300,000 when I came to Purdue for all of the experiment station, and now agronomy department gets more than that alone, and animal science gets more than that alone. And the budget today for the experiment station, or when I left, was $8 million, and I expect it's probably $9 now, but it was $8 million when I left. I just want to give you one little side comment here, and you'll probably want to knock it off the tape after I get through, but you can leave it on there.
Well, no, you want me to take it off?
No, just leave it on there. It's a little interesting incident.
Please do.
When I came up to Purdue, I had in mind this business of really developing a graduate program. I came from Wisconsin, which had a strong program in agronomy and soils when I was there. The year that I was a graduate student at Wisconsin, I think they had more graduate students than Purdue had graduated in agronomy and soils at the time I came here. That was back in the 1 year, see. Well, I just wanted so badly to build a strong program like the one that I admired so highly at Wisconsin. And I left Alabama to come up here because I thought that opportunity presented itself. I had about $30,000 in grant funds from industry. And these industry people came to me and said, if you go to Purdue, the money is going with you. We're not going to leave it at Auburn. I said, well, that's not fair to Auburn. It's all right, you're going to Purdue, the money goes with you. I said, well, I went to see the dean, and he said, that's all right. He said, that money was given to you because you were here. So at least he said that. He was kind enough to say it. Well, I came on up here and I brought that money, and this was during the Second World War. I knew about 25 or 30 outstanding boys in the Army that had gotten their MS degrees down at Auburn over the years. A number of them under myself, a number of them under other people. So I said, I wrote letters to every one of these fellows. And I said, I have moved to Purdue. I'm head of agronomy now and also director of the experiment station. And we are going to develop a program here that's equal to the best in the nation. We'd like to have you as a partner to come here as a graduate student. We're going to get some outstanding people in to help train you. Would you be willing to come? Well, I got a whole bunch of replies back. All but one of these boys answered, and 12 of them wanted to come to Purdue. Well, my $30,000 wasn't enough for 12. It was almost enough because you only paid them $100 a month then, you know. So I started writing letters to these fellows, and apparently somehow or other, Dean Young, the dean of the graduate school, heard about this. So he saw me on the street one day. He says, "Say, Norman," he says, "I understand you're inviting a bunch of graduate students to come to Purdue to do graduate work in agronomy." I said, "That's right." He said, agronomy has not approved for the PhD program. And I said, well, Dean Young, I says, I don't know anything about that. Well, I said, whatever the bottlenecks are, better get them removed, because I said, the boys are coming. I never heard another thing about it. Next time I heard, the agronomy was approved for the PhD program. Well, that was the start of the...
It's hard to fight against, hard to say bad things about an administration that's that active, isn't it?
Yeah, he went ahead and got it approved without, of course, in the meantime, I brought in two or three good men that were really highly qualified.
Of course, young, being a man in agriculture, knew what you were doing, and he could appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, of course, his background was agriculture economics, and he knew. But of course, they didn't have approval before that. I didn't know that, but that wasn't my concern right then.
Well, sir, is there anything more we ought to put on here?
Well,
I think this is a remarkable record, and I think it's an excellent one, and I know we can, it will be intelligently used.
Well, I might say that I can send you, I just might say from a personal standpoint, I do consulting in tropical agriculture. I'm still a consultant for the United Fruit Company and have been since I left them in 1936. And I do agricultural tropical consulting for other people. I've traveled through many countries of the world doing this type of thing. I find it very interesting, especially as a retired activity. What was your question you were going to
ask? Well, I was going to ask you, is there anything more you think we ought to put on? I was going to ask you about your hobbies, but apparently you've just told me. That's a wonderful one. Yeah. How's your Spanish? Good?
No. My Spanish, I don't use it enough to... I could still hire and fire people and get a place to eat and a place to sleep and get around, but I couldn't carry on a conversation.
You speak Portuguese?
No. I don't speak any foreign language, though I could. I was able to read German, French, and Spanish at one time, but I can't even read them anymore because in administration you don't have the need for these things and you get rusty off.
Has your tropical agriculture work taking you to Africa?
No, it hasn't. I was supposed to go to Africa, but when I was with United Fruit Company, but I chose to get married instead.
Probably a wise decision.
Yeah. I told him I was either going to get married and continue to work for him or resign and get married, one of the two. So that's the way that ended.
Well, is there anything more you'd like to put on? Now, you will put on the appendix of your honors and so on. And,
yes.
Now, we have not mentioned national associations or major publications. You will put in a list
of those. I can get a list of those for you.
What's been the toughest administrative problem you've had to lick here?
Gee, you know, they just haven't seemed so tough. I think I would say the toughest problem has been getting facilities.
And it's getting buildings.
Adequate facilities.
Yeah.
Adequate facilities. Staff we seem to be able to get after we once got rolling. And graduate students, we got plenty of them once we got rolling. We had a good selection. Funds we seem to be able to get. Now, I think that they're going to have problems from now on out.
Well, that's facilities because really of the nature difficult. Of the economy, isn't it?
Facilities really difficult. Improvement of our facilities and so on. This is a problem we fought from beginning to end. New farms and this type of thing. This is the thing that we...
Yes, I knew Mr. Throckmorton that gave you the Throckmorton farm.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Well, sir, if there's nothing more, may we call this the end of the interview.
Well,
the end of the tape.